Blog Talk Radio.
Throughout my life, I've been a searcher, looking for truth, trying to determine
who I am as an individual, where do I fit. And I tried various things, and I looked at various different thought processes and ideas that I tried to affix myself to. I was a Rastafarian in my teenage years. I obviously, in Jamaica, we started off as young people as Christians, because that's what we basically were indoctrinated into during the 400 years of slavery that we suffered as a people in the diaspora. Later on, I went into Zen Buddhism and got heavy into martial arts, and then I explored a little bit in the activism and politics and trying to find my way and direction in those areas. None of those things answered my questions, the searching questions that I was asking in relation to who I am and where do I fit in the scheme of things in terms of the global reality, until I heard a lecture by the Honorable Louis Farrakhan. And the way in which I've described it previously is that for me, it was like a light going on in a very dark place. It was like if you can imagine walking along a beach and there is a fish flopping around on the sand, and you pick that fish up and throw it back into the water. That's how I felt when I heard the teachings of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad as taught by the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. And I felt that I'd found the answer to the various questions that I was continuously asking in my mind and heart. And by the grace of Allah, I've been practicing Islam now in the nation for nearly 20 years, and really been trying to help the minister in trying to raise the consciousness and the level of our people from where we have been placed, and trying to deal with this inferiority that we've been subjected to, and at the same time, in the same token, dealing with the equally false place of white supremacy. And the idea and the concept in the Nation of Islam is that we raise the black man and woman from the false place of inferiority, whilst at the same time we pull the white man, the Caucasian, down from the equally false place of supremacy, so that you have one coming down, one going up. We meet in the middle as equals, and we can deal with one another on the basis of freedom, justice, and equality, and instead of this master-slave relationship. So that's, in a nutshell, you know, where I'm coming from and my standpoint on this particular subject matter.
This program, the cows, context of white supremacy, I have unfortunately concluded that we are in a global system of racism, white supremacy. I use those two terms interchangeably. I use the same definition for both terms. That definition is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you believe that such a system exists, and do you think that definition is accurate?
I think, brother, you know, your definition is 100% accurate. I think it one would have to go some to actually top such a definition, because it really speaks into the reality of what's taking place on our planet right now and has been going on for at least 500 years. And in reality, if we look at the teachings of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad for the last 6,000 years, and it's important to understand and to recognize that despite the fact that you now have a philosophy or a school of thought that purports to say that everybody is the same, now there are, you're no longer able to identify between genders and all of this kind of stuff. There's like a type of homogenization taking place where they're trying to create mass confusion by saying that there are no differences. It's very, very clear in terms of the reality that historically, when you look at Africans and black people, whenever people have visited us from Europe or from other parts of the world, we never discriminated against people on the basis of the fact that they were different, on the basis of the color of their skin. We were very welcoming. We opened our arms to people. We recognized that they were different, but we accepted that they were human beings with a difference. The problem, however, arises from the psyche or the mentality of Europeans and Caucasian people who, because of the nature, maybe we can get into that a little bit later, but because of their very nature, have a predisposition to say that other people are inherently inferior to them. They just cannot help themselves. This is a part of their fundamental nature, where they have been pre-programmed to believe that they are naturally superior and that they are to dominate other persons on the planet who are non-white. And so this is the reality of what's happening. There are many, many Caucasian people who are very confused about their nature. They themselves wonder why they do what they do, because they don't necessarily understand it on an intellectual level, but on a purely mechanical or instinctive level, they have little choice in the behavior that they have manifested on a global scale.
Wow. Okay. My co-host, she is also in Justice. I believe she also has some questions that she would love to ask you. Justice, if you have some questions you would like to ask Mr. Leo Muhammad, your line should be open. Please go right ahead.
Hello, Mr. Leo Muhammad. I actually have a few questions for you. Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
How did you become informed about racism, white supremacy?
Well, the teachings of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad really gives us a very comprehensive knowledge of the origin of people, the origins of races. And in a very basic way, I will just run through it very quickly. And that is to say that the black man and the black woman, we have no birth record. There is no scientist, no anthropologist, no historian on the planet who can give you a birth date for the black man and woman. We are so ancient that in the scriptures we are referred to as the Ancient of Days. For as long as planet Earth has been here, we've been here. And it is only recently that the other races have come onto the planet. The black man and the black woman, we are indigenous to planet Earth. And this can be proven at no limit of time. But approximately 6,600 years ago, one of our great scientists determined to create or to conduct an experiment where he recognized that within us there were two people or two germs, what's called the brown germ and the black germ. And he determined that he could bring out of the original man, the original woman, the black man and woman, bring out from us this anti-type, like another element of us that is really like you might call the negative side of us, the side of us which is the brown germ. And he went about this process, and apparently it took 600 years to make this process complete. And in that genetic engineering process, he grafted systematically from black into brown, into yellow, and finally white. And these increments were in 200-year periods. So there were three sets where we went from black in this grafting process, brown, to yellow, and then ultimately to the Caucasian white man. And this is how the Caucasian people came onto the planet. And, you know, it might sound something strange, but in reality, if you do very rudimentary studies of Caucasians and you see how they question their own origin and how, for instance, wherever they go on the planet, they never refer to themselves as native anywhere because they are a brand new people onto the planet. And wherever they went, they found artifacts and great edifices of our civilization's past. And this is why, for instance, in the English language, you will hear such terms as wonders of the world, where they would look at something like the pyramid and they're wondering how they were created, who built them, because they can't understand the level of technology that went in, into building these things in what they would refer to as ancient antiquity or prehistory, before their history began, which is a very relatively new history, which is why, for instance, when you look at somewhere like North America, when the Caucasian first went there, this is why he names things in the way in which he does. That's why New York is called New York, because Old York is in England. That's why they have places like Newfoundland and things of this nature, New Zealand. Everything is new because he is a new man on the planet. And so it's, you know, it's very important to understand when we're looking at white supremacy and its origin, where the psyche comes from that would produce such a phenomenon. I hope that goes some way to answering some of your question.
When you were telling that, hello?
Yes, ma'am, I'm here.
Okay. When you were telling why you agree with Gus's definition, you used justice and equal. When you say those two terms, do you mean,
yes.
Do you mean the same thing?
Well, you know, I think I used the term freedom, justice, and equality. You know, everything in nature is created to have a degree of freedom, a freedom of expression, a freedom of growth, freedom of movement, and so on and so forth. And that's the right of every human being on the planet. The problem is that as black people, as African people, as indigenous and original people, our freedoms have been greatly curtailed by the European, by the Caucasian, who has become the master dominating the planet over the last 6,000 years, but in specifics, the last 500 years or so, speaking specifically now about the transatlantic slave system and the legacy of that, the results of that, and how we come to be in the contemporary reality. So freedom is a necessary part when we're dealing specifically now with human beings. Freedom is a necessary part of the human life. It is something that all human beings should have. It's a God-given right that we should have freedom of choice. We should be able to have self-determination and determine for ourselves what our destinies will be. Justice, which I think is, my brother said that's your name, justice is a very beautiful factor in this whole equation that, again, human beings should be subject to justice. We should be able to achieve justice in life, because in the absence of justice, it actually makes the human being insane. It causes an imbalance. And if you look at the symbol of justice, oftentimes it's depicted as either a woman or a man standing with a set of scales, and the person, the statue, is blindfolded, because justice should be colorblind. It should not see color. It should not see gender. It shouldn't see any of these things, and the scale should be balanced. It should be fair, and you should be able to go in a court of law or in any society and get justice. And again, equality, one of the factors is that all human beings are created really on an equal basis. We all come in making the same sound, whether we are black, white, Chinese, Asian, it makes no difference. We all come in making the same sound, and we all go out making the same sound. We're not born necessarily speaking the multiplicity of languages that we speak. We all come in crying for Ma, and we all go out taking that last breath. And so there's an equality in humanity But that often time again is missing because some people are more equal than others based on a very unfair and unjust system, and they have built into society class systems where some people have and some people have not. And so this is what I meant when I talked about freedom, justice, and equality is what we as members of the Nation of Islam and we as indigenous original people would want to give to humanity when we have the opportunity to rule and to govern the planet again, as it was in the beginning, so shall it be in the ending. Are you there, ma'am?
I actually have a few more questions. I saw some video of you on YouTube and Google. How is your work constructive in working against racism, white supremacy?
Well, you know, some of those lectures, I think you may be referring to some lectures that I've given in Hyde Park Speaker's Corner. And, you know, living in the United Kingdom, for black people in the United Kingdom, it is quite often a very hostile environment. It is a place where black people struggle to make ends meet and to take care of our families and to aspire to and to achieve our goals, because there are so many overt and covert restrictions and obstacles placed in the way of our growth and development and our natural living that we are constantly fighting, battling on various levels, be it social, political, economic, trying to just survive. And so as members of the Nation of Islam, I don't know what you know about the nation, but the nation has had some very, very hostile and some very, very bad press from the mass media that's controlled by white supremacists. And as a result of some of the very ugly and hateful things that they say about the Nation of Islam, we determined that we would take our message to Hyde Park Speaker's Corner in London, England, which is a place set up in the 17th century for those elements within a society, within the society, who are dissatisfied, those elements within the society who are unhappy at their treatment or who have something of a political, social, religious nature that they want to express. And the government in the United Kingdom is very wise. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad said that the Caucasian person, the white man in England, is the wisest of all the Europeans. And they're very wise, which is why I think that this country is one of the only European countries that's never suffered a popular revolution of the people, because they are so wise that they set up Hyde Park Speaker's Corner so that people could go there and in the manner of free speech, people could go there and vent their frustrations and speak about the things that otherwise would be bottled up inside of the people. And in venting their frustrations, what would then happen is that the government would send agents to listen carefully and to monitor what was being said, to analyze and to determine whether it was a revolutionary message, whether it was an egotistical message, whether the speaker was just enjoying the sound of their own voice, etc., etc. So it's a good place for them to gather information about the type of spirit that's in the people, in the populace. But we went there knowing all of this, knowing that they would be analyzing and voice stress analyzing us and seeing if we were on an ego trip or if we were for real. We went there essentially to send a message to the government, to really warn them to lay off the Nation of Islam, to step back from their plans, because over the years since we've been establishing ourselves in the UK, they have attacked us on a number of occasions, attacked our school, tried to prevent us from educating our own children, because they're very afraid of black people educating ourselves, especially from a God-centered perspective, from a righteous perspective, and not being emotional, but being analytical and mathematical in our approach to how we build our future. And so we wanted to send a message to the government and to the other agencies and elements who are there to gatekeep black people and to keep us in our place. We wanted to send a message that we are here, that we are fearless, that we are challenging white supremacy, and that we will not be stopped, and that we will prevail. Because you may not know this, but the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan has been banned from the United Kingdom since 1985. He is not allowed to set foot in this country because they're so fearful of what he has in his mouth of truth that can transform the lives of human beings that they don't want this man to be here. And the idea of banning the minister was to stop the growth and development of the Nation of Islam from ever taking root in the United Kingdom. But as you can hear from your brother speaking to you this evening, they failed abjectly in that mission because the Nation of Islam is here and we are alive and kicking, and we are doing our very best to propagate and to spread the teachings of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad as taught by the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. And that's why we go to Hyde Park Speaker's Corner and give the message in the way, in the manner in which we do. Yes, ma'am.
What do you like about doing the work you do?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. You know, what I like about it, in truth, is that there is nothing greater than when you are involved in something that's bigger than yourself. And this mission, this work is so huge, it's so big, that I take tremendous pleasure from the fact that I am playing my part, my role, in something which is so much bigger than me, and something which is potentially so beneficial to masses of people on this planet. And so I really come alive when I'm given an opportunity to recite the teachings of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I really come alive when I can see the faces of our people lit up as a result of hearing truth. There's a scripture in the Bible that says, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." And I find it to be wonderful when you give truth to people and you see that light coming on in their face, where they recognize truth, because it's not something strange. It's something that's in the people already, because we are born, we're fashioned, we are created in truth. And when truth comes externally and connects with that inner truth, it resonates. And you just know, yeah, this is real. You know, because there's a vibrational dimension to it which connects. And I love to see that happen to our people. I love to see brothers who were drinking alcohol and smoking weed and, you know, carrying knives and guns and doing all kinds of crazy things. I love to see that light come on and see them put down the drink and put down the weed, the drugs, and put down the guns and the knives and transform themselves and become, you know, people who are now thinking about past, present, and future. People who are now logical, and people who are now analytical and dealing with reality as opposed to the kind of fantasy world that they have many of us as people wrapped up in. And so this is what gives me great pleasure. It's knowing that what I've been given is so powerful that it transforms the lives of human beings. And I've had my own life transformed by it. And so what gives me great pleasure is sharing that transformational message, that messianic message that comes from the teachings with our people, and seeing that have the effect that it should have on them, and seeing people's lives being transformed. There's another scripture that says, "Be ye not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your minds." And I love to see that. I love to see the mind being changed and the mind being stimulated into a new thought process. And You know, because oftentimes, you know, when we talk about the liberation struggle, which is ongoing, we tend to focus on a lot of external things, when in reality, the transformation, the revolution, the turning, is something that must happen internally. It must begin within. If we're dealing with reparations for injustice, the repair must start with the individual. It must start with ourselves. And so this is what I really love about this beautiful teaching that we've been given from the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. It really transforms human beings and human lives. Yes, ma'am.
I know that you do public speaking and I do a radio show. What other ways can you think of to inform non-white people about racism, white supremacy?
You know, it's very, very important that part of what we do, it's that we are not one-dimensional. You know, in the United Kingdom, I'm also known as an actor. I appeared on television in a very, very popular black comedy show between 1991 and 1995. It was like a five-year period of this show called The Real McCoy. If you go on YouTube, you can tap in The Real McCoy, BBC, and you will see some of the sketches that we did. And what I would do as an actor and a writer is that I would try to put, again, the message into some of the sketches so that we were making people laugh, but at the same time, we were sending a message of upliftment, a message of encouragement to our people. At the moment, as well as my lectures and my activism, I also do a form of stand-up comedy, which I call edutainment, taking that term from the great rapper KRS-One, who coined the phrase edutainment. I do edutainment on stage. In fact, I was in Leicester, up in the north of England last night, performing on stage. And what I do in the edutainment stand-up is, again, I make the people laugh, but at the same time, I insert within the humor the message so that we're laughing, but at the same time, we're nodding. And, you know, humor is a very, very important element in the struggle. If we are involved in something as serious as the struggle, the liberation struggle of our people, it is something that is so serious, it's so profoundly dangerous that it can actually destroy us. And so we need from time to time some humor to lighten our mood and to help us to keep going along this track. And if you look at even the way in which the Caucasians use humor, they're very intelligent people. And during war, they will send comedians and entertainers into the war zone to entertain the troops, to boost their morale and keep up their morale. And we use, and we must be wise and use it in the same way. And so I use comedy because, again, it's coming in the spirit of a doctor. And the doctors, again, are very wise and clever. When I say doctors, I mean, let's use the proper term, the pharmaceutical companies who, and I'm not suggesting for a minute here that what they give as medicine is necessarily good or that it works, but oftentimes medicine comes with a bitter taste. And so a wise physician will sugarcoat the medicine in order that it tastes nice, and then when we swallow it, that bitter pill can do its work in terms of curing or alleviating what we're suffering from. And so, again, the humor couched, the humor couched around the message, the liberation struggle message, is a very good way of giving the word to our people. And so what we're trying to do, in effect, is to actuate what, for want of a better term, a cultural revolution. Because the whole culture, or that which passes as black culture today, is really very, very dangerous. You know, we have been given some of the most hateful concepts and ideas that now passes as black culture, from the foods that we eat, to the type of music that we listen to, to the type of thing that passes as comedy or humor. I mean, mostly very low down, very filthy, below the belt type of things. And so what we need to have today is a cultural revolution, similar to what Chairman Mao instituted for the Chinese, where every facet of Chinese life had to have a feature of that revolutionary process taking place, similar to what they're doing in Iran, where the whole country, the whole nation is on a revolutionary footing, where everything must incorporate some element of revolutionary change, growth, and development. And so this is how we have to approach this situation, in a very systematic, in a very mathematical, and in a very organized way. And we must come away from this idea that we are somehow, going to make progress in life and be successful as a people by being disorganized and, basically all over the place. We have to become very, very highly organized as a people and approach that which has been done to us and is being done to us, and yet they're planning to do to us tomorrow, approach it in that manner, because you cannot defeat mathematics with emotion. You can only defeat mathematics with higher mathematics. And so we have to become thinking people today and very, very wise in the way in which we approach this, and we have to try to be multifaceted in our approach to solving our problems. It's not one thing. It's a multiplicity of things that have to be done, and there are various types of revolutionaries and various types of people. You're on the radio doing what you do. You are a significant cog in that wheel in order to liberate us as a people. I'm in Hyde Park and in other places doing what I do, and then you have other people doing what they do. But all of us are valuable to the struggle, and all of us should be encouraged in what we're trying to do to further the growth, the development, the total liberation of our people. Yes, ma'am.
Wow. I really appreciate all of that information that you were just saying. Keep up the good work of replacing white supremacy with justice ASAP. Go ahead, Seth.
Thank you so much, sister.
Context of white supremacy. I hope folks heard that you cannot defeat mathematics with emotion. Very important. You were born in Jamaica and migrated to the UK. I believe in some of the lectures that you've given, I've heard you talk about arriving in the UK and your introduction to racism with the white students that you had in some of your classes. Can you kind of share some of those ugly experiences that you had when you first moved to the United Kingdom?
Yes, sir. It was a very strange awakening for myself. You know, one of the problems that we have, I think, as young people when I was growing up anyway, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, as we grew up, there was a tremendous amount of naivety and truth on my own personal part in Jamaica, because I really knew nothing about racism. It seemed like my parents and the adults around me were determined to kind of like shield us from the reality of, you know, world history and what had happened to us as a people. And so I found when I arrived in the UK that I was a very naive young man. I mean, I was only 10 years old, I think, at that time when I initially arrived. But there was a great deal of naivety. And it came as a little bit of a shock to me when I entered into the school system here. And I heard things like nigger mind. It's like a play on words. Not never mind, but nigger mind. Go black home. You'll be all white in the morning. Things like this, and, you know, name calling like coon and nigger and sambo and gorilla and monkey and all these types of things. And then, you know, when I would raise my hand in the class to answer a question posed by the teacher, because I felt like I was a pretty bright student when I arrived from Jamaica, because my school in Jamaica was a very strict school, and I felt like I was as bright as the next person. I felt like I was learning very well, and so I didn't have this notion, this idea of inferiority. It just wasn't kind of bred into us in Jamaica like that, because everybody I saw in government, for instance, was black. Everybody I saw in terms of the authorities, the police, the army, they're all black people in Jamaica. So I never really had a sense of this inferiority thing that so many of our brothers and sisters naturally have experienced in North America. So it came as a little bit of a culture shock to realize that there were people, other students, white students in my class, laughing at me every time I opened my mouth because I had my beautiful Jamaican accent. And then they thought I looked funny because I was a black person. And so within a very short space of time, I found myself in physical conflict with a white boy. And again, because I didn't have this notion that they were superior to me, and I had that, what I call the Caribbean fire still in my belly, I really went to war, brother. And it got me into a lot of trouble with the teachers in the school. And then I began to hear stories about the racism that existed on the streets in the UK. And I heard, not from my father directly, but from associates of his, how he had been chased through the streets by white boys. They called themselves Teddy Boys. I don't know if what the equivalent is in the States. If you go back to something like the classic story of West Side Story, the drain pipe trousers and the quiff hairstyle, that kind of rockabilly, I think that's what they would call it in America. They had an equivalent to that in the UK, and I think they called themselves Teddy Boys. And apparently these people used to attack black people with coins between their knuckles, with handkerchiefs tied around their fists, and, you know, black people would get beaten up. You know, there was reports of people being stabbed or beaten with clubs and all manner of things like this. In fact, there were riots in a place called Notting Hill in London in 1958, around the time when I was being born in Jamaica. And there was tremendous repression and oppression of black people within the society during that, leading from that time on upwards. And, you know, I experienced these things, and then as I grew a little bit more, I met with official racism, institutionalized racism, when I was, unfortunately, my family divorced, my mother and father divorced, and we had some very difficult domestic times. And as a result, I found myself in what they call a children's home. I don't know, again, maybe in the States it might go by a different name, but it's like an institution for young boys and girls. And I met with institutional racism from the staff within that place. Now, I'm talking about being 12 years old now and being, you know, regularly, systematically abused physically, not sexually, even though I'm pretty sure that that type of thing was also going on in some of these institutions in those days. But there was physical abuse in that, you know, sometimes you could be slapped around by one of these white so-called house masters or teachers who were running these establishments. And from there, I got into trouble with the authorities, with the police. And before I knew it, brother, I was in what they call a reform school, which is a euphemism, I think, for the junior prison. And I went into that type of institution. And then from there, I went into Borstal, which is, again, like an upgrade of prison experience for young people. If, for instance, as a young person, you committed a very serious crime, if you're 13, 14, 15, even the crime of murder, and they couldn't put you in a regular prison, then they would put you in Borstal. And then when you reach the appropriate age, they would then upgrade you to the regular prison. So I found myself in Borstal. And then I got onto this very vicious cycle of offending and incarceration and offending and incarceration. And became very, very confused and very disillusioned, very angry. I didn't know how to properly calculate what was happening to me. I knew that there was something wrong in this place I'd found myself, but nevertheless, I couldn't get off that treadmill for nearly 10 years. I was in and out of institutions all the way to prison, serving the longest sentence in one go was approximately 3 years. And, you know, in total, I may have spent as much as 7.5 years in one institution or another. And that threatened to totally destroy my life. And only by the grace of Allah am I sitting here speaking to you today, because I met with a lot of very, very dangerous situations along the way. And by the grace of God, I was able to extricate myself, finally realizing that I had to basically educate myself. And, you know, often I hear the story of Malcolm X, and I can relate to it to some degree, because a similar thing happened to me inside. Not that I heard the teachings whilst I was in the institution, but what happened was that I just decided to start to read. And as a result of reading and reading books like The Philosophy and Opinions of Marcus Messiah Garvey, I began to get an insight into some reality in terms of my history. I began to search deeper and further, and in time, you know, as I said, I finally heard the teachings of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad as taught by the Honorable Louis Farrakhan, and I was able to make that turnaround, that transformation in my life. And now I'm known in the UK as, you know, an actor, performer, a celebrity, quote-unquote, in my own right. And again, not that that's my focus, because it really isn't. I've turned down more television appearances and work than I have accepted, simply because I will not do anything which would reflect wrong on my direction, where I'm trying to go as a human being. I refuse to allow an enemy to make me, because I know that if my enemy makes me, he can also break me. And so I suffer a great deal in the United Kingdom, simply because I have a stance which I refuse to move from in terms of compromising particular principles. And I'm very proud and happy that God has given me that kind of mentality and that type of stamina, so that when Allah blesses me to be quote unquote successful, because, you know, this world sees success in terms of monetary wealth or possessions and so on and so forth. If that is to be the case, then it will be on my terms, and it will be because I have kept faith with my Creator and with my ancestors and with my people, not because I've compromised and sold out by accepting some trinkets in order to debase myself, debase my women, debase my people. I'm not prepared to make those types of compromises. And so that's effectively where I am, and that's the history, the kind of the legacy of racism that I've experienced in this country. They've kind of boycotted me as well, stopping me from appearing in things that I would like to appear in, stopping me, for instance, from going into the prison system, which I used to do. We had a very, very successful class that we ran in some top security prisons in this country for black men. They've since stopped us from going into these institutions because they saw that we were having success with trying to reform our brothers who were incarcerated. And so there are many foils and many blocks put in the way of Leo Muhammad and those who are like myself. But nevertheless, brother, we don't despair. We are not down. We're not depressed. We thank God and we're very happy, and we persevere. We understand that resistance is necessary in order to prove that we are warriors. You know, Bob Marley put it very beautifully when he said, "Soon we'll find out who the real revolutionaries are." You know, it's we can't stand up and say we're this and we're that. The proof of the pudding is in the eating, as they say. And those of us who stand up and say that we're struggling on behalf of our people, we must expect opposition. And if there is no opposition, then we're certainly not doing anything that has any merit in it. And so the opposition, I think they say you can tell the caliber of a man by his enemies. And I've had them all come out against me, brother. They've called me in the popular newspaper in this country Britain's prophet of hate. They accuse me of teaching hate because I tell the truth to the masses of our people whenever I'm given an opportunity to do so. And so, you know, this is the reality of life in the United Kingdom. Yes, sir.
Wow. real privilege to have him on the program, our guest live from the United Kingdom, Mr. Leo Muhammad. But folks, if you're listening, again, we are simulcasting. This is also being broadcast live at waronthehorizon.com. If you would like to call in to listen, the conference line is open. That number is 760-569-7676. And the code that you need is 948-656. So one more time, it's 760-569-7676. And the code is 948-656. I'm really interested because you talked about not only being mistreated by white classmates when you first arrived in the UK and being called all sorts of just hateful and ugly names, but also being in entertainment and, you know, declining roles that might not present you, a black male, in the best light. I know in this area of the world, a lot of black people, they get a lot of trinkets to go out and play roles that degrade black people, using the N-word, just a lot of buffoonery. I wanted to get your thoughts on black people calling each other the N-word. Are black people in the UK doing that? And if so, what is your view on that?
Yes, sir. The popular saying is that whenever America sneezes, Britain catches a cold, because whatever you see happening in the United States of America in terms of fashion, in terms of music, in terms of trends, it's only a matter of time before it comes here. And so almost everything that we see happening on the streets in the United States is happening here also, just on a smaller scale. But the reality is that we tend to follow and copy some of the good things that we see, but equally all of the bad things that we see. And so it's the same type of reality here. You know, my brother, this thing with the entertainment world, you know, there is a thing that we need to study into and come to an understanding about, and that is this: that the subconscious mind cannot distinguish between fantasy and reality. And what that means is that when you walk into a cinema, or maybe you say theater in the States, but we say the cinema here, when you walk into to watch a movie, when you walk in on a conscious level, you know that this is just a movie. You know that that's Al Pacino on the screen, or whoever you're watching, or Denzel Washington on the screen. You know that it's just a movie, that there's a director, there are people saying action, there are people saying cut, it's just fantasy. However, on a subconscious level, within 8 minutes and 20 seconds of that film starting, you find yourself in the plot. You may find yourself laughing, you may find yourself crying, you may find yourself becoming emotional, because your subconscious mind cannot distinguish between fantasy and reality. It takes what you're seeing as absolutely real. Now, I say that as a precursor to say, you see, brother, this medium of films is so powerful. It's not called movies just because the pictures move. It's movies because it moves the masses of the people. I read one study where they determined that most people in the 20s, 30s, 40s in America actually learned to smoke and drink as a result of watching movies where the stars all smoke and drank. And these habits were perpetuated via the movies where the people would see the stars doing these things and they in turn would follow along. Now, for instance, you know, Denzel Washington is one of few actors that I have children that I would allow my little girls to have a picture of Denzel Washington on their wall a few years ago, not today, but a few years ago when my children were smaller and growing up. And that was because of films like Glory, because of films like even Malcolm X, even though Spike Lee and those who paid him $35 million to make the movie had another agenda in terms of trying to point the finger at the modern-day Nation of Islam as being responsible for the death of Malcolm. That's another story. But my point is that this particular character, Denzel Washington, is, in my humble opinion, you know, a great exponent of that artistry called acting. And he has done some tremendous films, but he never got an Oscar. But now let's look at this film, Training Day, that our brother was involved in. And brother, I have never been to the cinema and watched a film where you had a lead character played by Denzel Washington, where the lead character had not one redeemable characteristic. Before the end of the film, I'm saying kill him. I believe that the star should be killed because he was so ugly as a character. Now, you know, I don't know that much about North America, but I do know that the LAPD do not have a good reputation historically with black people as a result of Rodney King and various other very high-profile racist behavior that has been perpetrated on the black community by members of the LAPD. And I know as a fact that even though some of those officers would have been black, the mindset that this type of brutality has been coming from has been a mindset of white supremacy, perpetuated by white police officers within the LAPD. But now, in one fell swoop, with Denzel Washington playing that corrupt police officer, who is then trying to corrupt and usurp and twist the innocent Ethan Hawke, the little white rookie, and you know, really coercing him into ugliness and filth and murder and crime. And then he has a mistress or a girlfriend I think it was like a Latin Quarter of the Hood, where this sister has his child. And when things start to go badly for him, he's willing to try and hide behind his own son, his own child. He doesn't mind his child getting killed, but here you have the white rookie officer who cares more about his son, cares more about his mistress, the Latino or black sister that's playing that role. And here you have a complete role reversal, where now the black man is the ugly villain, the white man is the soft, gentle, caring hero. And brother, you know, it saddens me to see somebody of the caliber of Denzel Washington would do something like this, because it is so dangerous and detrimental, and the message that it sends to our people is one of tremendous negativity. And it's like we took several steps backwards in terms of our progress, because that's how powerful these things are. These films are not just being watched in America or Britain. They've been watched in Japan, in China, in Russia, all throughout the world, in the Middle East, and everybody is having this thing translated. And as far as they're concerned, the ugly face of the LAPD has now become black. And as far as they're concerned, it may have always been black, because there's no explanation as to the real history of this type of thing. And so this is the power and the danger of this. Now, let's very quickly, brother, I hope you don't mind me expounding a little bit on this, but let's go to Halle Berry.
Okay.
Here you have a sister who, again, she is iconic in the eyes of many black females. Many black females, whether we like it or not, they may aspire to look like or to be like a person like Halle Berry. But then she's played, again, in many, many powerful roles, and I've never seen her come near to an Oscar. But what does she get an Oscar for? A film called Monsters Ball, where, again, for a mainstream movie, I have never seen a sex scene like that, where I don't know if you appreciate that many of the white actresses who are A-list so-called actresses, many of them won't even do nude scenes in films. They will actually insist that a body double is brought in order to do these things because they believe they have too much dignity in themselves. Now, you know, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I think it's important to just appreciate how, for instance, prison officers are seen within society. They are on a very low rung in terms of the psyche of human beings and the way they're seen. They're not seen in a very good light, the jailers, the prison officers. And when you have an iconic figure, a quote-unquote, one of the most beautiful black women in the world, but yet in the movie, bearing in mind what we said about the subconscious and the conscious mind, in a movie she is coupled with one of the lowest forms of life in terms of a prison officer. Not only that, but this is the very prison officer who is responsible for taking her on-screen husband's life, played by Sean Puffy Coombs. And, you know, I mean, there's so many elements in this in truth, but I don't think we've got the time to go into it. I'm just saying that it's very, very dangerous to see how, you know, the type of roles that we will accept and that we will play, not realizing the ramifications and the way in which this type of thing is being used against us as a people and how it perpetuates white supremacy and black inferiority, where you have that iconic image of a woman now lowering herself to be with a prison officer, a prison guard who cares nothing about his own son, who he basically forces to commit suicide, who cares nothing about his own father, who he puts into some kind of old people's home when he gets fed up with him. Yet we are to believe that this black woman is to now form some type of loving relationship with this type of individual. It's really, when I watch things like this, brother, it really does strike me as tremendous naivety on the part of some of our actors that we will even accept such roles. And I haven't got the prestige or the money of these people, but brother, as God is my witness, you could not offer me such a role, and I would take, Leo Muhammad would take such a role. I just would not be there, brother, because I understand how these things are used in order to continue our oppression as a people.
Again, live from the United Kingdom, Mr. Leo Muhammad. Man, hope you all are appreciating the information. Justice, if you have some questions you would like to ask Mr. Muhammad, your line should be open. Please go right ahead.
Mr. Muhammad, if you have offspring, how do you help your offspring understand racism, white supremacy?
My sister, this is imperative. You know, again, I think I mentioned a little bit earlier how, for instance, when I came to the UK, how naive I was about history. And this is because historically, I think sometimes our parents think that they're actually protecting us and by not telling us the reality and the truth. But if you look at the Jews, for instance, a highly intelligent group of people, they will never stop indoctrinating the planet about their suffering and their pain and what has happened to them. And if you ask them, why do you do this, they will tell you emphatically, because if we don't, this may repeat itself, it may happen again. And we should be the same. We should teach our children the reality of what's happened historically, regardless of the fact that we may now be living next door to some white people who are very nice, and they treat us nicely, and we go over for barbecues now and then, or whatever the case may be. You know, we tend to want to forget history on the basis of some very tenuous relationship that we may have with one or two Caucasian people today. But that's very, very wrong and very, very dangerous. We must tell our children the truth. Our children must be informed in order that they can be pre-armed, forewarned and pre-armed in order to deal with the inevitable racism that they will meet at some stage or some point in their life. It will make itself manifest because that's the nature of the beast. They just cannot help themselves. They have a particular nature which will make itself manifest. If you look at the situation with our brother Barack Obama at the present time, you know, there was a lot of hysteria and excitement over the fact that here you had a quote-unquote mixed-race brother who was becoming the president of the United States of America, and there was lots of excitement and lots of new voters came out, young people voted, and so on and so forth. But, you know, if you really have a good look now at what's happening with this brother, one, he hasn't been able to make the type of changes that we thought he was going to make, because you can't join another man's system. As much as we may think the president has power, he really hasn't got the power we think he has. There are other forces behind the scenes who are far more powerful, the ones who selected him before he was elected. Before he was elected, he was selected. And he was selected because they wanted to use him as a tool in order to further white supremacy on a global scale. It's not what we think it is that we're looking at. But the point is that here you have this black man in the White House who is now being pilloried and really treated like, you know, the lowest form of life in some elements of the media in North America, and by some of the political classes, particularly among the Republicans. The way they're treating this man and the kind of things that I've read and seen him being called Hitler and all kinds of ugly names. I mean, this is the reality of racism and white supremacy. It doesn't matter. You know, I've never seen a president, George W. Bush, George H. Bush before him, Clinton, none of them. I've never seen a president of the United States who makes a statement basically criticizing a policeman when he arrested Mr. Gates, I think it's Gates, because he dared to criticize this lowly policeman, he basically had to invite the policeman into the White House to have a beer and apologize, because as a black man, even though you're the president of the United States of America, how dare you insult one of our lowly white policemen? And this is how deep this thing goes. So we must inform our children, because if we don't inform our children, then they may be looking at Mr. Obama thinking that, you know, wow, we've arrived, when in reality, it's not the case. It doesn't mean that his presidency is without merit and that there isn't something that we can take from it in terms of just our aspirations, just the aspiration of young people. That they realize, well, man, I could do that. I could do anything, because there is merit in that. But in terms of the reality of this man and what he faces and the type of vice-like grip that those international bankers and neoconservatives have him gripped in that Oval Office, that man is in a vice grip of death. There's nothing he can do. He is just there to be used and for them to put a black face on global hegemony and white supremacy. They want to use us in the same way in which they used Denzel Washington in that movie, in the same way in which they used Halle Berry. It's all part of the same process. Nothing really changes. It's just a metamorphosis of the same behavior. It just takes on a new form, but it hasn't changed. It's not that racism has gone away. We're not living in a post-racial society. These are myths perpetuated by those who are wickedly wise, and whilst we are thinking that we've arrived, they continue with their agenda.
Do you celebrate Halloween?
Sorry, my sister?
Oh, I said, do you celebrate Halloween?
Oh, that's a strange question. We were, before we got on the radio with yourself, there was some knocking at my front door, and it was children apparently wanting to ask trick or treat. And I don't want to sound like a spoil sport, but I can assure you that my door was not answered. I really don't get into these white European holidays, be it Halloween, Valentine's, Christmas, any of these things, sister. These things are really not for us as a people. I mean, you imagine, we're now to celebrate dressing up as ghouls and goblins and ghosts and vampires and this type of freaky, crazy kind of idea. We don't get into that. We try to keep our house as sane as possible. We like to have some sanity, and we keep our children away from that type of activity and behavior because, you know, we don't believe in tricking and we don't believe in treating.
Yeah, I agree. That is really, really scary.
Yes, ma'am.
White people say today's so-called Halloween. All of my listeners, I would suggest to not celebrate any of that foolishness. However, what was the scariest thing that ever happened to you when speaking in public?
Ooh. I don't know if I've had any really scary experiences, but I mean, what has happened on occasion when we've been speaking in the public is that we've had people in the crowds who have come. We've had Caucasian people who have come in the past trying to create an atmosphere of trouble, trying to provoke an incident. If you look at some of the tapes when I'm speaking in the park, for instance, I'm always surrounded by the members of the Nation of Islam, by the FOI, our security, and sometimes they try to provoke an incident with the FOI in order to try to divert attention from the message and maybe try to get us into a fist fight or something like that. And while we were going down there for approximately 3 years, there was a couple of occasions when people did go too far in trying to push us, and we had to respond in a physical way. So this has happened, but by the grace of God, we always prevailed, and we never, ever allowed anyone or anything to disrupt what we were trying to do. But from time to time, when you speak, every now and then, there's been a situation where, you know, you may get a heckler or somebody trying to shout you down or shout down what you're saying. But again, we have to develop a laser beam focus in what it is that we're trying to do. And regardless of what the detractors may be attempting, you just go right on and get your message across. And so, I don't know. I can't ever remember being afraid or being made to feel afraid. I do remember once I was to give a talk in a top security prison in the area in London called Brixton. It's actually Brixton Prison. And I was told that there would be 80 black men in attendance for me to speak to. And when I arrived at the prison and we were shown into the actual place where I would be speaking to the men, there were about 50 black men, and they were about 80 white men, and then there were about 35 to 40 prison officers, most of whom were white, standing around the walls. And that was a little bit disconcerting because I came expecting to speak to black men, but here I had white men outnumbering the black men and then more prison guards around the walls, and it just seemed like maybe I was supposed to be intimidated and I wouldn't be able to give my message. But by the grace of Allah, I went ahead and I gave my message, and at the end, all of the black men were very pleased, and they came up and they were, you know, very appreciative of what was given. And many of the white men came up and were also appreciative and giving congratulations on the talk that they heard. And many of the prison officers, again, on the way out, they were very, very humbled. I saw them kind of, you know, they had to acknowledge grudgingly that they had heard something that even they couldn't contest or couldn't say that it was hate or that it was negative, but that it was very uplifting for the men who were incarcerated. And if those prison officers were really listening, they would have even gotten something for themselves as well. Because that's the nature of what it is that we give. If we can rise above emotion into the thinking, the analytical and mathematical thinking of God, then we would recognize truth when we hear it. And we wouldn't become emotional, and because we're talking about white people or Caucasian people, they just switch off automatically and become very angry and emotional, and Leo Muhammad must be a racist. No, I'm not a racist. I'm a truth teller. And truth is no respecter of persons. Truth doesn't care whether you're black or white, young or old, male or female. It's just truth. And as my great brother Bob Marley said, the truth is an offense, but it's not a sin. You know, truth can be offensive. If you say to somebody that you love them and they declare on dying love for you, and then 6 months' time the relationship breaks down and they say, I don't love you anymore, you know, as painful as it may be, that's the truth, and we must learn to move on. But if we refuse to recognize it as truth and we insist, and now we're going to stalk the person and we're going to push them and we're going to force them into a relationship, well, then that becomes very dangerous. And, you know, that's something that we must avoid. We must learn to recognize truth, even if the truth is against us, even if the truth hurts. It's good, and it's not a sin. It's not something sinful. It's just truth.
How did you learn that wearing military uniforms and staying confident is threatening to white people? And can you share other strategies to have a constructive effect when talking to white people?
If I understood your question correctly, did you say, how did I learn? Just say the first part again, please.
The first part was, how did you learn that wearing military uniforms and staying confident is threatening to white people?
Oh, I see. You know, I mean, the thing about the uniform and military is that everything in nature actually has a military bearing. And, you know, you can start by studying the ants. And, in fact, they have some ants that they call soldier ants because of the way in which they conduct their life, the way in which they go about building their homes, the way in which they go about taking care of their families as ants. Now, that's a very, very low form of life. And as human beings, if we think that we can actually be progressive and constructive and, you know, successful without adopting a military element to our lives, then we're in real trouble. Because without that organized way of doing things, without that military structured way of conducting ourselves, then we can never, ever contend with a world like this, which has every nation has its military, and we have to begin to think in that way. The great Marcus Messiah Garvey who formed, I think, the largest black organization in the history of North America, numbering into, I think, 5 or 6 million people in the 20s. He had a very military element to what he was doing, with uniforms and everything. And it's very, very important within that that term. Uniform is unity, uniformity. You know, it's a very powerful concept. And when people know that they're dealing with a uniform body of people, in other words, you're not dealing with an individual. This is not about individuality. This is about a unified group. And so you can't touch one without touching the other. Then you become very powerful. People will respect you. And in terms of, you know, being intimidating to white people, if I understand you correctly, or not being intimidating, you know, again, it's about the Christians have a very well-known saying in terms of their creed. And it says something like this: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And in truth, if you really wanted to know, that's my religion. That's my philosophy. That's the way I live my life. You know, when I'm treated with respect, I must respect whoever respects me. I cannot be disrespectful to people, regardless of their creed or their class or their color. If you are respectful in your behavior, then it's incumbent on me to be reciprocal in that behavior. However, if you are disrespectful to me, then please don't expect me to be respectful. It's just the two things just don't go together. There is no congruency in that. And so that's really the law that I live by. I live by the principle that if I don't want people robbing me, then I mustn't rob people. If I don't want people coveting my goods, I shouldn't covet theirs. If I don't want people talking about me behind my back, I shouldn't do it to them. And if we live by that simple rule, that simple philosophy, think about how you would like to be treated. That's how I treat people. And whenever I meet white people or other people, I am very respectful. And I always will try to step into their shoes for a moment in terms of thinking about, okay, how would they receive what it is that I'm giving? Now, that will not stop me. The idea that somebody may have hurt feelings or somebody may not like what they're hearing, that will not stop me from delivering the truth. But you have to be wise in the way in which you give truth, and that you don't just bludgeon people with it. You don't just – everything has a season, and there's a way in which you give these things. And, you know, again, I go back to the fact that I do a form of stand-up comedy that I call edutainment. And, you know, sometimes when you're on stage, live on stage, you really have to think on your feet. It's not always that you can stick to the script that you had memorized in your head that you're going to give to the audience. Sometimes something may happen. You may see something. Somebody may walk in late. Somebody may even shout something, echo or something. And you have to be able to think on your feet and be able to capitalize on that moment, because it may be a very good moment to enhance that edutainment experience, that comedic experience. And so in life, I think, you know, like when I'm in Hyde Park as an example, and I speak in the public, then I expect after I've spoken that people will want to ask questions. And I can't be resentful that somebody may ask a question that may be critical of something that I've said. It's natural that if you speak in a public place, then the public has a right to question you. And what I try to do, like for instance with this show that we're doing this evening, I don't try to preempt your questions. I don't want to know the questions in advance. It's just important that when you ask the question, that I listen very carefully to what it is that you're asking, and then I make an attempt to answer the question based on the moment, as opposed to some preconceived idea about what the question is or what the answer should be. I really try to keep an open mind, and I really try to listen carefully. And on the basis of what I'm hearing, I make a computational assessment, and I try to give the best possible answer. And I know that the answer I'm given is not necessarily definitively the only answer. It's one answer, potentially of many answers. But it's the answer that is best suited to that particular moment or what it is that the Creator brings into my heart and mind at that particular moment to give as an answer, as a response. And what's important is that unlike, say, for instance, the mentality of a politician who may blow with the wind and may supply answers to questions that suits the particular crowd, you don't do that. What you have to do is you have to maintain some kind of integrity within what it is that you're saying. And if you go back 15, 20 years and look at my track record, there should be congruency between what I was saying then and what I'm saying now. It may have matured, it may have seasoned, it may have grown in terms of its understanding, but it should still be the truth. We should never detract from that. The Honorable Louis Farrakhan teaches us that we should compromise on everything except one thing, and that's the truth. You never, ever compromise truth. But there's always room to compromise on this and that and the other in order to facilitate agreement, in order to try to move things on and move things forward. But when it comes to truth, we got to be very, very resolute when it comes to that. And if we're not prepared to die for the truth, then we shouldn't be ever prepared to speak truth unless we're prepared to actually lose our lives for it. I hope that answers your question.
That answers my question, and go ahead, Gus.
Context of white supremacy, again, real privilege to have our guest with us today. Live from the United Kingdom, Mr. Leo Muhammad. Last question I wanted to ask, and then I wanted to check, because we have quite a few folks that called in. You said earlier, unless I heard you incorrectly, that white people they are predisposed to mistreat black people, to practice racism, white supremacy, and you even when addressing the importance of educating our youth, that they are inevitably going to come in contact with white people who intend to harm them because they are black. Given that you've shared that, do you think that white people will be able to have a correct relationship with black people at any point? Do you think that it's possible that white people can peacefully, justly coexist with black people at any time?
That's a very, very good question, brother. It's a very, very difficult problem to solve because you're really talking about changing the nature of something. You're talking about changing the nature of someone. And, for instance, we are taught by the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad that the nature of black people is righteous and that we are unrighteous by circumstance. We are righteous by nature, unrighteous by circumstance. And we are taught the opposite in relation to Caucasian white people, that they are unrighteous by nature, but some of them will actually manifest righteousness based on circumstances. And so you have both people who have the ability to actually live or act against their very nature. But the problem still exist that the predisposition of the black man is righteousness, so that nature is always sitting up under all of this filth and unrighteousness that we're doing. We have a very pronounced conscience, which is always plaguing us and keeping us awake at night, where we know that what we're doing is absolutely against our better instincts and our nature, whilst at the same time, the Caucasian who is doing righteousness and fighting his tendency is leaning towards unrighteousness is equally in a battle for his life. But we are taught that the greatest battle that you will ever fight, that you will ever, the greatest war that you will ever wage in this life is not a fight or a battle. Please forgive me, brother. That's the phone ringing. It's going to be answered now. It's not a fight or a battle with an external enemy, but it's a fight and a battle with the internal enemy. It's the war or the battle of self. In Islam, you will often hear them talking about this in a very misguided way on television. It's called jihad. And jihad is not warfare against some force on the outside. Jihad is the perpetual warfare that has to be waged against the internal enemy, against the negativity of self, against that voice that comes up that tries to get you to negate the reality and the beauty of yourself, and to do that which is ugly and unseemly. And so this is a battle that we are constantly to wage on that negative element within self. And so, you know, I have no doubt, brother, that there are some white people, and in fact the scripture says that some of these people, if they just help us with a glass of water, they will be given blessings, and that some of them will actually see some element of paradise. We're talking now about heaven. We're not talking about some place off in the sky. We're talking about the kingdom of God here on earth while we live. But they will actually see some of that, those who will do righteousness and do good by us as a people, those who will repent, sincerely repent of the wickedness which has been perpetrated by their forefathers, and that they will look effectively at repairing the damage, because they are responsible for that which their ancestors did, which has now brought us into the condition that we're in. And so there are some on the planet who I am convinced and I know will do valuable and good things in order to affect repair of the black man and the black woman. But in truth, our focus should not be on coexistence with them. Our focus should be on existing among ourselves, coexisting among ourselves, uniting among ourselves, integrating among ourselves, learning to love, honor, respect, and uphold ourselves. If we would do that, then the power that white supremacy has over us would dissipate overnight. Because it's our thinking about them and constantly trying to educate them or convert them or reform them that really takes away so much of our energy and disallows us from actually doing for ourselves and becoming the successful people that we will be and that we must be and that we will become. And so in my humble opinion, there is a possibility that there is some type of mind technology that could be used to reverse this type of this tendency, this behavior. And again, if you understand over the 600-year period that the white man was being made, a process of lying, murder, went into this making. What they had to do was that they actually would marry. If you, for instance, I don't know if you have children, but if you have children as a black man, if you look carefully at your children, you'll see that one is always lighter and one is always darker. But if you look at black people, two black people together, one is lighter, one is darker. There are so many different shades of black. We are never exactly the same. Within families, you will have one slightly lighter, one slightly darker. And how this grafting process took place, this genetic engineering took place, was that as the babies were being born, where couples were mating together in order to produce these children, as the children were born, they were examined in minute detail for who was lighter and who was darker. And the dark ones, the black ones, would be killed. They would be dispatched. And the light ones would be kept. And the light ones would be married onto lighter ones. And so on and so forth. And this process went on for 200, 400, 600 years of killing the darker, marrying onto the lighter, and lies would be told about what happened to the black ones that were killed. Now, this process went all into the very nature, the very psyche of how these children were made up, through lying and murder. And so this is how it becomes the very essence of their character and the very essence of their nature. They cannot help it. evil and wickedness comes out of them like a web comes out of a spider. And they will justify the most heinous crimes, the most evil behavior known to man. You cannot even begin to fathom the depth to which they would go to justify evil and murder. When you look at something like the Iraq War, you know, that's as a classic example. Guantanamo Bay, these things, all based on lies. But this is the kind of reality that is taking place when it comes to the nature and the characteristic of these people. And so I personally wouldn't hold my breath trying to find, you know, these good white people. I'm more interested in trying to reform myself and becoming the best human being that I possibly can be. And like I said, it's not about going around being hateful to another people, but it's just recognizing that once you've been bitten by a snake, don't waste time looking for venomous snakes. Just stay away from all snakes. Just be aware that it's a snake. You know, it's whether it's got venom or whether it can crush you or whether it can, you know, squirt the venom into your eyes, it's a snake. And you just got to understand that they have a particular character, a particular way that they move. And that modus operandi never changes. And so you just have to be very mindful. And when you know the nature of things, you no longer fear that thing. You no longer have to be, you know, in trepidation around that thing. In fact, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said he'd make us so wise about the Caucasian that we would have him around our little finger and we wouldn't even be aware that he's there unless we looked. And that's how we want to approach this situation, not in a spirit of vitriol and hatred and, you know, or even with this profound hope that one day we will be able to reform them. All we can do with them is to give them the information about the reality of their origin, who they are as a people, what their divine mission is, and that they have a limited time to rule. And that time, by the way, is up. According to the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, their time was up in the year 1914. And so every year that you see the white man continue to rule in the manner in which he is, it's an extension of time. And really, the truth, if the truth be known, he will continue to rule until you and I get our act together, until you and I recognize that it's our time now and we step up to the plate with knowledge, wisdom, and understanding, meaning that we really recognize that it's our time now to take back the mantle of rulership on this planet, not to subjugate other people, not to then turn them into slaves, but to give them freedom, justice, and equality based on the fact that we have suffered over 400 years of the most heinous treatment ever meted out to any people in the history of this world. And as a result of that profound suffering, we know what it means to feel hurt and pain and to be deprived and to be disenfranchised. And so as a result, we don't wish that on anybody else, but certainly we no longer wish to live under that type of oppression. And our job now is to bring justice to this planet. I hope that answers that question in some way, brother.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Again, our guest live from the United Kingdom, Mr. Leo Muhammad. We had quite a few folks that dialed in. Is it acceptable if I check a few of the folks that called in if they have a question for you, sir?
Oh, yes, sir.
Okay. Person who dialed in, last four digits, 8586. Did you have a quick question? We don't have a lot of time for long commentary, but if you have a quick question, 8586, your line should be open.
How both of y'all doing? Y'all have a quick question for the brother. Did you say that white people were made and it took 600 years to make them?
Yes, sir. That's what I said. Yes, sir. That's the teachings of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad as taught to us today by the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan.
All right. Okay. Well, since the brother said that you couldn't answer long or anything, can you refer me to where I can get that information from? Because that's one of the key issues that's coming up to me in my street battles. So can you do that for me, brother?
Yes, sir. There are a number of books. If you go to NOI.org, that's the official website of the Nation of Islam, and you can go in search of the book, Message to the Black Man in America, Our Savior Has Arrived, and Fall of America. If you look for these books by the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, all of the information in relation to the making of the white man can be found in those books. In particular, Message to the Black Man in America. That is the book that you need to purchase in order to begin to really get a comprehensive knowledge of this process of grafting or genetic engineering through which the white man was produced 6,600 years ago.
Okay, brother. Yeah, I appreciate that. I'm going to definitely research that.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir, for calling in. Appreciate that. Person who called in from a blocked number, if you called from a blocked number and you have a question for Mr. Muhammad, your line is open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, Mr. Muhammad. I have a question for you. I do enjoy listening to some of Minister Farrakhan's speeches, and I have a couple of books from the Nation of Islam regarding Jews and blacks. I would like to know, what position does the Nation of Islam take on the genocide and warfare and enslavement of black people in Africa by so-called white Arabs, who supposedly are co-religionists or practice Islam?
Yes, it's a very good question, ma'am. And the position that we take is that we condemn slavery and oppression by whoever perpetuates it. And the reality is that when Satan comes, when an evil person comes, they never come and say, I am Satan or I'm evil. They always come disguised as an angel of light. And so, for instance, when Sir John Hawkins came in 1555 from Britain on a ship named Jesus to begin the enslavement of black people, he came on a ship named Jesus. He came as a Christian. He came as a righteous person. And then within a short space of time, he was perpetuating some very evil practices and taking our people out. The same thing with some of these Arabs. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, taught a very pristine and pure Islam, something which is wonderful in its ability to transform human life when you consider the condition and the state that the Arabs were in before the revelation came to Prophet Muhammad and the revelation of the Quran was revealed in that region of the earth. But what happens is that some of these Arabs would take their evil behavior in terms of wanting to enslave black people, but put a coating of Islam on top of it, calling themselves Muslims, in their ill treatment and their enslavement of black people. But, you know, the people who came as Christians were not Christians. They were not practicing what Jesus taught, but they were masquerading, hiding behind Christianity. The same with these Arabs who came and enslaved Africans, black Africans. They are masquerading behind Islam, but they are not Muslims. No Muslim or no Christian or no true Jew, no true believer in God could perpetuate such evil, perpetrate such evil on people. It is just a mask. And so we must understand that religion is not what we say from our mouth. Religion is what we do in practice, because action speaks louder than words. And so quite often when you meet so-called religious people, you will meet some of the biggest hypocrites on the planet, because we speak religion from our lips, but our practice, when observed, is something completely different. And so this is how we should understand this type of behavior when we hear that Arabs were involved in enslaving black people. It is absolutely true. But make no mistake about it, it was not the system of Islam that did this. These were people calling themselves Muslims whilst perpetuating evil on another set of people. I hope that answers your question.
I was speaking to the present as well, but thank you.
Yes, ma'am. I think, yeah, there are things happening in the present time as well. I think there are some things happening in the Sudan. And again, it makes no difference whether it's historical or present day. The reality is that there are Catholics now who are charged with sexually abusing children, minors. These are not Catholics. Not if these are not true believers in God. These are people who are wearing a label, but their practice is that of Satan. I do hope you understand how we are to really look at these things.
Blog is ebonynewschannel.blogspot.com. Once again, her blog, ebonynewschannel.blogspot.com. Thank you for calling in. Mr. Nero, did you have a question for Mr. Muhammad? Mr. Nero, your line should be open, sir.
Greetings. May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Real quick. Thank you, Mr. Muhammad, for coming on the show. I just would like to know your definition, sir, of justice.
Justice. Well, you know, brother, it is about making a judgment based on balance. You know, one man's justice is maybe another man's injustice, but it's about being fair. It's about recognizing that in every situation, there are more than one side to the situation. There's always two sides to the story. If you go and observe a court case, when you hear the case for the prosecution, it will be very easy to condemn the accused, and you know that's the end of the case. But if you wait and then listen to the defense, you might change your mind. You may see that there's another side of viewing this. And so justice for me is about hearing both sides and then making a decision based on the truth, the veracity of the evidence. And based on evidence, then we can administer justice. And this is how I understand this concept. It really is about being fair in the way in which we treat other human beings, regardless of who they are, regardless of their color. And so if my black son offended the other man's white son, and the evidence was brought to myself, regardless of the fact that he's my black son who offended against his white son, if the evidence condemns my son, then I must give justice to that white man's son, because that's justice. Justice should be colorblind, it should be genderblind, it should be fair. It should be, because that's how you preserve the sanity of humanity. Once we have a world that's based on injustice, it causes those who do not get justice to become insane. In other words, they get mad. They become angry, and then anarchy becomes the order of the day. I hope that explains my concept. My definition of justice is very simple. It's not a intellectual analysis. It's really just based on common sense.
Excuse me. There was a person listening in, Tater Pie, black female, non-white female. She was listening in, and she just wanted to know the example that you gave about if your son, black male, did something incorrect to a white person's son.
Yeah.
She was saying this in that example, would this be during the existence of white supremacy, or would this be after white supremacy has been defeated and we're in a just society?
No, it's during the existence of white supremacy or after the existence. It makes no difference. You know, I think there's an old saying that two wrongs don't make a right. And we have to be very careful that in our effort to defeat wickedness and enmity that we don't become the very thing that we say that we're against. And so we, you know, you have today some black people who may say, well, look, man, you know, I've been so disenfranchised that I've got no money, I've got nothing, so, you know, I can justify selling crack cocaine or some other kind of drug to my people because I've got to make ends meet. I've got to make some money. And, you know, the white man has done this evil to us, which is true in terms of the disenfranchisement and the inability for many, many black men to make a legitimate living today. And so we can turn to pimping or selling drugs or whatever. But in reality, in truth, we're falling into a trap. And we cannot justify such behavior by saying, well, injustice has been done to me, so therefore I'm going to be unjust to myself and also to my people. That's not a correct analysis of how we go about bringing justice to the planet.
I see. Thank you for the clarification, sir. Person who called in last four digits 1422. Did you have a question for Mr. Muhammad? Did you have a question, or are you just listening? Okay. I will assume they are just listening. Justice, did you have another question that you wanted to ask Mr. Muhammad?
Yes, I did. How has being on this show helped you replace white supremacy with justice?
You know, what you are doing yourself, Justice, and Brother Gus, it's really invaluable. You cannot quantify the value of such a program as this. And by you allowing me to come on and say the things that I've been able to say this evening, I hope and I pray that there are those who have listened or who are listening who would just have a little bit more insight into, one, the teachings of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, two, this concept of white supremacy, which is defeatable. It's not this all-encompassing, powerful entity which we're going to live with for the rest of our lives and we're condemned to suffer under it. No. It's something that's defeatable, and it's actually easy once we understand the fallacy that undergirds this concept of white supremacy. And so, therefore, I'm very pleased to have had the opportunity to come on your show and to speak with those who are listening and to speak with yourselves about such a subject, because information is important. Knowledge is important. There's a scripture in the Bible that says, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. And it's knowledge that we need today. We need knowledge. We need to grow in knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. There is too much ignorance in the world. And that's our number one enemy, ignorance. And the fact that we don't know based on actual facts. We guess and we surmise and we conjecture. And there's all kinds of things that passes today as information, but so much of it is confused. So much of it is without merit. So much of it is regressive. And so my being able to come onto this show and share some of that which I am learning as a student of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan really gives me great joy and gives me hope for the future that there will be more shows like this, and I'll have more opportunities like this to share more of these life-giving teachings, because this is what it's about. It's a question of life or death, and I've chosen for myself life, and I want to see my brothers and sisters living at their optimum level, and I believe that with the right knowledge, wisdom, and understanding, some of our brothers and sisters who are currently out there in the streets with their pants hanging off their backsides and they're on this kind of drug or that kind of alcohol, or they're involved in this kind of street organization, what they normally would call gangs, and they're into guns and violence, or, you know, whatever the case may be. I know that those people, they have a most beautiful heart buried under the filth and madness of this world. And all they need sometimes is a little spark just to let them know, oh, man, I'm not mad, I'm not crazy. Because they've had all of these thoughts for all of their lives going around in their hearts and minds. There's something inside of them that's constantly telling them that they weren't born on the planet just to be surviving from day to day. That they're great people. They can achieve great things. And so I hope that when I speak, something is sparked within such people where they realize, man, I've always known that that was the truth. I've always known, because it resonates, and that they will begin to make that change, that transition, that revolution within their own lives, and they themselves can become part of the solution as opposed to being part of the problem. So that's how I feel about having this opportunity to be on the radio with yourselves this evening. Thank you for the question.
You're welcome. I don't have any more questions right now, but thank you for being on today's show. Keep up the good work. Hope to have you on again sometime, and have a good night.
Thank you very much, Justice. You take care.
Mm-hmm.
Context of white supremacy. Man, it was quite a pleasure to dialogue with you this evening. I feel like I learned a lot. It was just invaluable to have someone come in with your insight and from a totally different spot on the planet to share their perspective on white supremacy. We would love to have you back on the program to continue the dialogue. I know you're super busy, but perhaps down the road, if you have a free moment, you definitely have an invitation to come back and we can chat it up again and discuss some of the other issues, because there are things I didn't even get to that I saw in your lecture. So if you would be interested, you definitely, we would love to hear from you again, sir.
Please feel free, brother, to contact me anytime that I can help and I can be of service. That's my duty. That's whenever we're given something of tremendous value, it's incumbent on us to share it with others. And it would be my honor, privilege, and pleasure to have an opportunity to assist you and that which you're trying to do on behalf of our people. Anytime you wish to contact me in the future, please feel free, and I will do my very best to be available to assist and help in this process, because as we go deeper into the 21st century, a lot of ugly things are going to happen, and we have to be armed with this knowledge, this wisdom, this understanding, if we are to survive and come out the other side. And so whenever I have an opportunity and you would want me to participate in something, please feel free to contact me, brother, and it would be my great pleasure.
Again, just real honor to have him on the program live from the United Kingdom, from the Nation of Islam, our guest, Mr. Leo Muhammad. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I will definitely be in touch with you soon. I wish you continued success in everything that you do, and I will definitely be in touch with you soon, sir.
Thank you, brother. May the Creator bless you and all that you endeavor to do in his name, and I thank you very much for this opportunity. May Allah bless you.
Thank you so much, sir. You as well, and we will be in touch soon. Have a fantastic evening, sir.
Take care, brother.
Thank you, you too. Context of white supremacy, we are wrapping up, but Gus will be moving over to Sister Nefertari's program in about 60 seconds. So you can tune in to War on the Horizon. We'll be chatting about For Colored Girls Who Considered Suicide, When the Rainbow is Enough, the new Tyler Perry film that's due out this week. Children of Southampton, we will be chatting it up, and we'll be back in approximately 5 hours. We'll be back for Sara Sutensetti. He'll be on the program 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Pacific, and 7 p.m. Excuse me, 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Pacific. Sarah Sutton Seti, that is the evening broadcast. Very busy day. You can come right on over War on the Horizon if you're listening there. You're great. If you're not at War on the Horizon, just go over there and you can listen to Gus T. Renegade and Sister Nefertari of Children of Southampton. Thank you, everyone, for tuning into the broadcast. We will be back later this evening. And Justice's email address, justice.asap@yahoo.com. Thank you so much for tuning into the Cows. We will be back soon. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately.